Dorothy.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean. For some time, I've been trying to get a friend of mine to participate in this particular program, and he did while he was in Connecticut. He co-hosted one show, but he happens to be in South Carolina with me today, and we're dedicating this show to his mother, who passed away last month, and her name was Dorothy. I'm speaking of none other than the great Paul C. Willis. Good afternoon, Mr. Willis.
Good afternoon, Doc. How you doing? I'm hanging in there, man. I'm doing the best I can with the little bit I got to do with, you know.
Right? You know how the story is. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, we're in Paul Willis' car, riding down to my sister's house where we can get set up for the show, but we didn't get back in time because we had so many other business of things to take place and was worried about my cousin who had to be rushed to the hospital because he couldn't breathe. And so I've been trying to keep up with that situation. In any event, you are listening to Getting It Done. And today we're dedicating this particular show, at least 30 minutes of it, to Paul C. Willis's mother. Now, what's so remarkable about that is that every mother and father, if they were living with you and were part of your life, they dedicated a certain amount of their time and life to making sure that life was better for you than it had been for them. And so I'd like for Paul to see if he can talk a little bit about some of the kinds of things that his mother did for him that he can remember that, and highlight that the particular things that really allowed him to become the great person that he presently is. Mr. Willis.
Yeah, well, that was a heck of an introduction. But, I think what's important about my mother is the fact that she was very creative. She was very independent. But probably more importantly, what she did was that she really allowed for everyone in the family to be independent and to really become the person that they want to be. And so with that, it was quite interesting. She always was very creative, as I said. She loved to cook. She'd always talk about her home life, where she grew up on a farm. But she always took care of everybody. She took care of the household very well. She was an amazing financier. But she always had a creativity about her, and that, which I would always remember. She was very kind. She was a giver. She gave of her time. She gave of her energy. She gave of herself to everybody in the family.
You know what's so remarkable about that whole situation is your mother, like most mothers, I can say that from the kind of mother that I had, for some strange reason, were special, and we only had one of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was great to have her for 94 years.
Wow. What a great.
And she had celebrated her 94th birthday in May of this year. So, yeah, she gave us everything.
I remember her myself when she came over to me when you got married, after I finished singing, and she said to me, "So you are Walter Dean. My son often talks about you. He thinks of you very highly. And now I can see why, because you sound so great when you sing. It seems so sincere." And I looked at her. I didn't know who she was, because you had and then you came over after that and you said, "Oh, did you meet my mother?"
Exactly. Oh yeah. I mean, it's She was very on top of things. And as I said, she just allowed for everyone to be themselves. And even though that she didn't, she only went to the 10th grade, I remember that she was always interested to see what I was learning, and then my youngest sister, what she was learning. So, I mean, so all in all, she kept on top of things. She loved to crochet. She gave us, she would crochet blankets for everybody. So it was very nice. And you could talk with her. She was a great listener, and you could really
find a therapeutic gear, right?
Exactly. You know.
Yes.
So I'm going to miss her a lot, but I've learned as much as I could, and hopefully that I can end my life in the same vein and purpose.
Well, all I can say to you, Paul, is that you were lucky enough to have had her for as long as you had. My mother was gone away from me when she was 78.
Exactly. That's young. I don't know whether that's young or my mother was that old.
Well, today, 78 is a little much younger than we would imagine, you know. It's not like like 15, 20 years because of the amount of medical advancements that have been made.
Exactly. She was, she was relatively free of any kind of sickness. I mean, she was very strong, very healthy. And she had five.
Let me hear their names. So if they're listening, they will know that we have been taking care of her.
Okay. Tony was the oldest. Steve is the next one. My sister Marie, myself, and then my youngest sister Tina. But my family had developed and worked with the different forms of cancer. So the one that hit her was breast cancer. And but I know that in her last few months, she was very concerned about saying, like, where did this Corbett come from? Where did it come about from? But she was good. Even to the end, she wanted to do things by herself. She wanted to walk by herself. She wanted to do things and was very on top of her, again, as I said, her independence. And she always wanted to do things by herself.
Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about the accomplishments of your family? Because she was all that, let me finish what I'm going to say, because see, I know you. You're going to jump in and pontificate even before I even ask the question. But you know, like what I find to be so remarkable is that mothers are the foundation of many kinds of things that we eventually go on to do. Because I know that my mother had a lot to do with my singing career. You know, my mother was a pretty good singer herself. My father was too. But my mother was the kind of person that nurtured my singing. And so, while you, ladies and gentlemen, this is my brother-in-law who just walked in and he was asking how goes it. But that's okay. We're pretty free here in this family.
Mm-hmm.
That's the great Eddie Griffin from Connecticut, who everybody knew from the Hartford area. As the former coach of Buckley High School, as well as a basketball standout at the high school in Hartford, Connecticut, and later on played basketball for college at Virginia State, later in also in the Midwest, and you know, later on tried out for the Dallas Cowboys. But more importantly, let's get back to your parents. But I just wanted people to know who voice that was.
Right.
Because, you know, like sometimes it's important when people will text me and say, well, I heard that voice in the background. Who they say that when I say who that?
Exactly.
But then more importantly, I'm quite sure based on me knowing you and your musical career, your mother must have had a hand in it somewhere.
Well, I think her role in it was really having the she loved Broadway show tunes, and so, and my father enjoyed country and western music, so I would listen to their record collection every single day. I remember that when I was really young, I'd listen to it, you know, all day long. And she couldn't understand why I was listening to it. Everyone else never did. Exactly. Now, she wasn't musically inclined, neither was my father. But later on, a neighbor wanted to form a band, so he asked me if I wanted to play some drums. And they were very supportive in telling me to go down, pick out the drum set that I wanted, and I was doing my music. But she also was involved in that as well.
Drum set?
No. She would tell me which one do you want, and that was the one that I bought. But they also helped me with that as well. But she was also she also enjoyed square dancing. She always enjoyed that for like about 10-15 years.
She also believed that your mother was a yahoo.
She was an excellent dancer. She was an excellent dancer out there. And she later, everybody would always say like, "Oh, your cooking is so good." Well, she put that to the test, and she was able to have blue ribbons at three country fairs.
Ooh.
And she won first prize.
She did some embroidering.
Exactly. She had done one for a scene of Bear Lake in Colorado in the back of my shirt off of a postcard. So you talk about creativity and then having somebody out there in Colorado recognize the place. Now, that's saying something for some creativity.
Yeah. That means she was pretty good at what she did.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And as I said, I mean, she was good at her cooking. So she had a very full life, I would have to say, without any kind of regrets. I know I had told my mother to, like, you know, to forgive if I was yelling or screaming at you. And her words were very strong. I don't remember. The only thing I remember is that you're my youngest. And that was it. So I just said, like, that's good enough for me. That's good enough for me.
Well, I had an opportunity to meet your brother also, Tony.
Uh-huh.
I was teaching school at Vine Street Elementary School. It's been changed now to the Thurman Milner Elementary School in Hartford. And evidently the principal had a contract with Tony to run a I think it was like a production, some type of
children's theater
kind of thing.
Right.
And so I had an opportunity to meet him. He was coming up the stairs because the auditorium was upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And right behind him, I thought it was Tony, but then another person came up looking just like Tony. That was you. That was way back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was the name of the production company that you guys had?
The company that he created was Plum Cake Players. And he had that for like about 5 years in the greater Hartford area. Did original plays for children's K through six.
It's surprising that your brother never took the time to write memoirs about the whole process that he did and putting that whole thing together and implementing the plan and structure for it. Because, you know, today people are all about the business of actually trying to pass on information about things.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ever get a chance, you might want to talk to him about actually putting that to paper.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, what's important there is the fact that when you look at a lot of children's theater, you see a lot of productions that come from either fairy tales or
Walt Disney or anything else along that nature. His was not of that nature. It was put together by the people within the company, and they would do the productions themselves. So it was all original casting for the different shows. And it was very participatory theater. So it had each group and each grade, each of them had a function during the play to do something. And that was difficult to do. Not many people could go out there and really handle a group of young people, kindergarten through at least third grade, and keep them under control, and where they were engaged and were very active and concentrated on the play itself.
That reminds me, because Vine Street School at that particular time, the name wise, was the kind of community that had some rough kids.
Exactly.
And they were well entertained because nobody had to put anybody out of that auditorium. So, and they would, if they didn't appreciate it, they would have let you know that this is boring as stoop. You know, I really don't want to be bothered with this mess, you know. But they seem to hold on and provide a certain amount of respect,
mm-hmm.
and appreciation for what was being done. And when you told me later on that your brother decided to go to another direction and do some other kinds of things, that it sort of I wanted to talk to him about the possibility of not just concluding that, because, see, your brother doesn't even realize he could have gotten his doctor's degree from just writing about that whole process.
The whole process, exactly, exactly.
You see, what he did had a curriculum structure.
Yes.
And it had a programmatic curriculum structure that provided an opportunity for participation by students. It was participatory,
mm-hmm.
where students could participate in that. And I really appreciated the creativity that was suggested and presented. And therefore, knowing something later on that it was your brother, after we got to know each other,
uh-huh.
Then I said, wow, how the good Lord moves.
Well, he exactly. And the thing is that he later on went into, got his teaching degree, and he taught in the West Hartford school system, and he still maintained doing at least a yearly production with the class that he would be teaching in doing a play as well. He didn't have time to do the regular kind of the theater productions that he had when he had the company, but he was able to do things in that vein with his own class. And so he maintained that aspect of his career.
I'm quite sure, Dorothy, your mother was very proud of Tony. So tell me a little bit about your other offsprings.
Well, I mean, it's my brother Steve was good at playing the accordion and also playing piano. He was very good with that. My sister Marie was.
Hey, wait a minute! Are you gonna even your brother? With that little small amount of stuff?
Well, I mean, he was into it, but he never got into
what is he doing now?
Really playing. Right now, he's enjoying retirement.
Yeah, okay. I can agree to that.
And every now and then, he sits down and we play. Marie never got really involved in with playing any kind of musical instruments. Tony did. Tony played guitar as well. I became involved in with playing drums, got involved with bands, and currently continuing my musical career by doing recordings, doing my original songs, and playing in that way.
Well, would you tell my audience a little bit about, first of all, the very first thing that you created that was in written form?
What was that?
The plot thickens.
The plot thickens. Go ahead.
No, I can remember you having a television show attached from the NAACP. You used to be the director for public relations for the local NAACP branch, the Greater Harper NAACP branch, and you had a television show. And in order to do that, somebody had to write script and somebody had to do an introduction. Somebody had to do a conclusion. So the writing, to me, was I would assume that you did some of that.
Well, I did some writing. I put together the shows on top of that. I put together a newsletter for the chapter. And you were instrumental in that, of putting me on that
committee. You were on two committees.
Yes, yes.
First of all, when I became president for the Greater Harper NAACP, I wanted to make sure, Ben Andrews and I wanted to make sure that you were involved with us because he had so much respect for your ability. I don't know if you ever knew that or not.
That I didn't realize. That one I did not realize. I was just hoping just to maintain myself and to present a professional product in every which way and form. And really worked my committee and my shows that I eventually did with Carl Focus
was
that? On.
Yeah, what was the name of the show?
Focus On.
Focus On. All right.
Yeah.
It's too bad the NAACP doesn't have something like that right now.
You would think we left them a legacy. We left them something to continue on.
Yeah.
And, you know, they continued. I think it was a couple years after we had left. But, you know, it happens as you go through. So I did the shows, became involved in also doing some radio shows.
Yeah, that's right. I remember you having a radio show at the
Community
University.
Affairs.
Yeah, you also had a radio show at the University of Hartford called Within and Around Your
World.
Exactly. And who did we had some very interesting.
We had people from the community. We had mayors, former mayors within the Greater Hartford area.
We had a championship. Marlon Sterling.
Marlon Sterling, yeah.
Yeah.
And we also had different state senators, Congress people that would be involved. So we had that as part of my development within that field. I then went into being elected on the Bloomfield Board of Education.
Yeah, that must have been truly interesting, especially when the superintendent of schools was one of my friends.
Exactly.
Paul Copes.
Paul Copes.
Dr. Paul Copes. I pulled him out of the classroom and trained him and helped him become a supervisor and teacher corps, and so later on he moved on up to being a principal of Weaver High School. Started off as assistant principal, then vice principal, and then principal.
Okay.
And
okay.
From there, he moved on to be an assistant superintendent of schools, and then left there to go over there where you were in Bloomfield and become superintendent of schools.
And he did a good job with the town, elevated the school to a good. Not the blue ribbon status of the school, but he brought the scores up and did a good job.
Yeah, he was one of these kind of people that I'm quite sure that Bloomfield was sorry they allowed him to leave. But because the person that came in after him, I heard, was a great failure. He's a person who was an absolute fool.
Exactly. And then he later had gone down into Fairfield, Connecticut, to be a superintendent down there.
Yeah.
But it was. But
let's get back. We done jumped off of the point. You didn't get a chance to tell me about your sisters.
Right. So as I said, my sister Marie was not really involved in with music, but my youngest sister, Tina, was really good at in playing. The saxophone.
Oh, I'm going to tell you something. Audience, you know, most times that you come in contact with people who, and we're talking about your mother, evidently she saw fit. How did she get involved with Tina? How did that whole thing happen?
She had taken care of. She enjoyed children. She totally enjoyed children. Yeah, she had quite a few. Well, she had five of her own here, but she wanted to have. But she took care of foster children. Most of the kids came out of the hospital, and she would keep them for maybe the longest was maybe 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she had taken care of 58 in her lifetime, and.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
I never knew that your mother was that deeply involved with the taking care and nurturing
yes.
other children.
Yes. My aunt had started to taking care of a couple of children. She didn't last too long in doing that because she really she had a hard time dealing with her own children. So that's all a different story. Long and short of it was that my sister who had, she had like lazy eyes. So her eyes would go like from one end to the other end. And so she didn't really want her. And she asked my mother if she wanted to take care of her because she didn't want to anymore. So my mother said, okay, fine. So that's how Tina came into the family. So my mother finally told and said, okay, we're going to have a family meeting. And she said, like, I'm not going to take care of any more children. This is the last one. But let's have her for the family. And I remember that very clearly. It was a group meeting. And my mother said, you know, do you want to have a sister? And we all said, yes, we agreed. And that's how she became involved in with the family.
More so, you know, what I find to be so remarkable that this young lady that you're talking about, Tina, who you just said, your sister, was a remarkable track star.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and...
Now, wait a minute now. The reason why I'm saying that, you know, people always need encouragement. And we see, this is a show, these 30 minutes of the show are dedicated to your mother. We start talking about a lot of other things. But, you know, if one really wants to look at the character of your mother, we can look at the accomplishments of her offsprings, her children. And if one were to look at Tina, a child who was not her own, that she made her own,
yes,
went on to become one of the state's great track stars in high school, and later on went to Brandeis?
No, she went to Tufts.
Tufts, it was Tufts.
Yeah.
I know it was one of those schools up there in the Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And then later on went on to become... an outstanding what?
Well, she married a
doctor,
orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah,
she has a good family with that. Both her children are now in college.
Yeah, she got children of her own
in college.
See, so your mother laid down the foundation.
Yes.
For Tina to be where Tina is. And she learned from your mother on how to be supportive of her own. So that whole lineage structure.
Yes. Continues. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I remember that she had gone down to different. She had gone down to North Carolina for some of the track meets that she was involved in. And like I said, she got involved in dealing with her music as well. So, yeah, I mean, and my mother liked to sing. She wasn't a great singer, but she always liked to sing along and do those kinds of things. So, yeah, I mean, I think that she left a good legacy for all of us.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you about your mother.
Thank you.
Because, you see, we often don't get a chance to go back and reflective thought is so critical in our continuous understanding and the mental development of the people we loved and continue to love, even though they're no longer physically here with us, but they will always be with us mentally. This is a strange thing that I'm going to say. Your mother will always live because in her gene, it's been transferred to you and your brothers and your sisters, and they have passed, those genes have been passed on. So your mother's gene will continue like her mother's gene and your father's gene. Those will never die as long as the human race continues. And so I want to thank you for being able to provide us with just a little bit of substance as it relates to Dorothy.
That sounds good, and I will appreciate that.
My pleasure. Okay. Now, but the other part of the show, I'm glad that you're here with me. The other part of the show, let me sort of give you a brief introduction,
okay,
so that we can discuss it in total. Picture this. The paper that Lincoln signed to free the slaves did not accomplish anything for a long period of time. This period not referred to and is referred to as the Reconstruction lasted from 1863 to 1877. This was for only 13 years. Do you want to discuss that?
Keep on going.
All right. What caused it to end? The resistance from white people in the country. The cost economically to pay for all the soldiers that were supposedly protecting the black people in the South.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the economics related to that. And something extremely important. The South had poor law enforcement. Do you want to discuss that?
Yeah, I think it's we're seeing it today again, where people inside law enforcement see themselves as a
judge, jury, and executor.
Yeah, exactly. Completely separate from everyone else. And but they don't understand. They take an oath.
Yeah.
They all take an oath,
yeah,
to protect the citizenry. That means all citizenry, not separate and segregated people. It's everyone that they have to, it's to really protect.
Well, let me go on a little further. As is now, there was a big dispute in the 1876 presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring a bell?
It sounds quite familiar to even today.
The KKK was developed, plus other extreme groups, just like now, in the Southern Democratic gained their power at that particular time.
Right.
The difference today is those that were Democrats are now Republicans.
Yes, yes. It hasn't.
Well, the party has changed.
The party has changed, but their message has not. And it's become a little bit more sophisticated. And so anyways, yeah, it's basically the same.
What happened then, we see are happening now. Let's see if I can present the comparison between then and now.
Okay.
First, then there was a rise of extreme racist groups that went about trying to keep black people and people of color from voting, leading the way.
That sounds like what's happening today.
Okay.
But that was then.
That was then.
Okay.
Leading the way was the Ku Klux Klan and the hanging of a large number of black men in southern states. The fear kept black people from voting, then and now, we have some of the same fear tactics, take your leg and your knee off my neck, taking place within the killing of black people
mm-hmm.
on and on, basically by the police force. It was hard to try those Klan members
mm-hmm.
in the past, and now it's hard to try the police who have taken the place of Klan members, and in some cases, are Klan members.
Well, that brings to the point of the three freedom fighters down in Mississippi. Where
they were killed, doing that.
And the sheriff and his deputies who were arrested but were never prosecuted. And again, those law enforcement officers again involved, but again were not prosecuted at all.
Well, it's a very interesting situation when you talk about in the 1950s,
right,
when Jim Crow was still in vogue.
Mm-hmm.
Black people were living in one part of the city, and another white people were living in another part of the city, in the north, not just in the south, but in the north.
Right.
And you had black people who in the south couldn't drink out the same water fountain as white people.
Exactly.
You could not go swimming in the same swimming pool with white people. You could not go to the same schools that white people went to.
Yeah, I don't know. To my understanding, the last time I saw water, I didn't see no color in it.
Well, there's no color in water, but just you got to understand, black people were segregated to second-class citizenship. See, we have what you might call three phases of development, and each phase of development causes 2 to 3 steps culturally backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me explain what I'm saying. As black people progressed to try to get equality, as they stepped forward with the utilization of the Martin Luther King period and the bus situation where somebody sat down and said, I'm just too tired to get up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I am just worn out, you know. You find there was a transition from Reconstruction, which took place and concluded in the 1800s, but was replaced by a thing called Jim Crowism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where they tried to continue to reflect the same structure of racism in slavery as they did later on. I mean, it's tried to where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
Also, with the aid of President Andrew Johnson, who developed the Black Codes, making black people second-class citizens in the South, which was a what?
Replicating?
Replication of the condition of slavery. See, you got to understand something. Slavery kept black people not in a second citizenship kind of structure, but even beneath it. They were not even considered humans.
Correct. Correct.
They were sold as cattle, like chattel.
Mm-hmm.
With the signing of the Declaration, the Emancipation Proclamation, they were elevated just above slavery into a serfdom kind of structure, which allowed them certain levels of freedom. And as they now were allowed to receive an education. They couldn't go to school with white people, but they still were able to get an education
mm-hmm.
because of the founding of the various kinds of colleges that were allowed to develop. Mm-hmm. So we have that step forward where they can now become, dispel the illiteracy that they were able, they had to maintain during slavery, so they could at least think and be productive in their thinking. Most often they were developing certain kinds of skills in slavery to build kinds of things for the slave owners. Every home that was built by a slave, masters made them build them and got the materials and they built them. See, so you want to understand something, that these African American people were not as dumb and stupid as most people tried to make them be. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, to go one step further, once Jim Crow, once Andrew Johnson put these black codes into place, those voting rights, those different kinds of things that black people, through the signing of the paper, supposedly got rid of slavery, actually continued into Jim Crowism to keep them beneath becoming even more so less than first-class citizens. They now function as second-class, supposedly, citizens. So with the eruption of the Klans that killed people and scared them to the degree, scared them to vote, those black people who were now actually in politicians were kicked out, where some of them were killed, and people could not, that were too afraid to vote for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So here we have a continuation of that same kind of situation today, when a policeman takes his knee and knows that he is choking this man to death with his knee,
mm-hmm.
is lynching this man, even though we're no longer supposedly in Jim Crowism and black people have moved just closer to becoming first-class citizens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as that process occurred because of the black president supposedly occurred, we're being shoved and pushed back by the present president of the United States, who's taking on the same and fostering the same kind of attitude and behavior as did President Andrew Johnson.
And don't forget, Woodrow Wilson was another individual who fostered that type of mentality.
Oh, no doubt. Woodrow Wilson actually went further than Andrew Johnson. He was the originator of the separation and unequal kind of thing, the whole process of the Plessy versus Ferguson.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So that whole process. Unequal education, but, you know, it's supposed to be fair. And look at them. I'm going to tell you, so we have Republicans right now who are rushing to put a woman who has out and out told you where her head is at, even though she's got supposedly two black children, to hide her level of racism. She's hiding her level of racism behind the auspices of these two black kids. She's trying to make people believe that that's not who she really is. But you see, actions speak louder than words. In her writings, she spells out specifically that she disagrees with this, she disagrees with that.
Mm-hmm.
And in each one of them,
yes,
is also pushing towards the same kind of structure and attitude and behavior that Hitler had in Mein Kampf and telling you what he was going to do, because the Aryan race was superior to all of the other races in the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that was also part of with the fascism of Mussolini. And if you can look at it by this president, by telling people that they have to go to polling stations to oversee, Mussolini had done the same thing of intimidating voters in Italy.
Well, they've been trying to intimidate voters. But you see, it's a little too late. is that right now you've got people, black people, who are a little different than the black people who were living way back in the 20s and the 30s
mm-hmm.
and the 40s. You know,
mm-hmm.
you got these little black, these black people, young black people today are not going to take that mess. They would rather die than give up their freedom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, whatever, and let's see, and you hear where black people at that particular time, back in the late 1800s, were not allowed to carry weapons. You got black people today, got all kinds of weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, they don't have just pea shooters, they got guns. And so, you know, I hate to see what's happening, but the thing, the way it's going right now, we're headed straight towards another civil war. This election is so important.
Mm-hmm.
If we do not have a election to get rid of some of these eggheads that are in office right now, we will actually have a civil war. You know, because you see, when you consider the number of black people who are in the services, the armed services,
mm-hmm.
there, and just see, you have a large number of black people who are in federal institutions, but you got also black people who are in the service.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them in Marines, in the Army, in the Air Force, and all over. And you think they're gonna come home and kill their own people?
No, and I certainly hope that they are aware of the fact of their commander-in-chief telling and labeling them as losers and who have absolutely no idea of what the heck is going on. So, I mean, it's, you know, you have to really look and hear what that commander is saying about you as an individual, and you have to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, you know, what brings it, this brings me full circle into the thought of really who invented lies. You know, the very first lie, who told the very first lie on planet Earth?
To my understanding, it was, what was it, the serpent?
That's right. And who was the serpent?
The serpent became, well, was the disguise of as a serpent, but again, it was Satan.
And where did Satan come from?
He had fallen out of favor with God and was kicked out along with his henchmen and kicked them out.
So he had some followers.
Yes, he did.
Yes. So.
Yes.
So if we were to take a look at the followers of him, it tells us what the followers of him are doing right now. Because we got a guy in the White House who does not know how to tell the truth, so he had to get that from somebody.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, either he's a demon or something. I don't know. I have never in my entire life, and I've lived long enough to come in contact with a lot of presidents and vice presidents, but both our president and vice president, both are on the insidious, stupid side.
Yeah, I mean, when the conservative pundits have come out and said that they that Bill Clinton told a lie and should be ousted because of the lie, but meanwhile the current president, who has over 6,000 lies, there's a problem.
It's scary. It's scary, right? When you have somebody who took an oath to protect the democracy and has done everything in terms of the Constitution to protect the Constitution
mm-hmm.
and our democracy,
mm-hmm.
does everything he can to destroy both.
Yeah, I mean,
do you think he ever knew anything about what the democracy is? Do we even know what the Constitution is?
No.
Because, you know, the last thing I heard him say was he was all about the business of staying in office no matter what. Yeah, I mean, that's a serious problem. That is a serious problem. That's what makes this country supposedly different from other countries, where the transition of power by the vote of its citizenry is a peaceful transition. And it's not full, or it's not where people take arms and everyone's going to start going going crazy because they don't like the outcome. Yeah, I mean, that's when someone starts inciting that, and
he's not following the Constitution. If he says that, if the voters say bye, you're supposed to leave.
I mean, the law is the law.
Well, what law? I mean, he doesn't pay attention to any other law, so why would he pay attention to that law?
Exactly.
No. The problem I have is, let me show you. I'm just going to do our dichotomy because. Oh, so let me pause for one minute, people, and let you know what's going on if you're listening. This is Getting It Done, and I'm your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and my guest today is the great Paul C. Willis from Connecticut. He's down here in South Carolina spending his vacation here with me, and we're over to my sister's house trying to make head and heels of what is happening in our little world that is was so precious, and the person that we have in office is trying to destroy. You know, see, what I find, so there's two levels of what I'm interested in saying. One level is that this man is from Germany. His family's from Germany. He's not from Germany. But, you know, I know what Hitler tried to do, and he was German. So. I don't know whether this young man right here, who's president of the United States, well, not a young man, he's an old man, why he is, because everything he seems to do in his division in destroying the Constitution in terms of fighting against the press, fighting against those people to speak out against him. We're talking about freedom of speech. We have the right to say what we feel.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of not only ourselves, but also the newspaper people, the television people, the radio people, all have a right to say what they feel.
Mm-hmm.
Those are part of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's all about the right to carry weapons, sure, but it's just not white people carrying weapons. Now we got black people carrying weapons. That's going to cause a big issue. Because the more this gets out of hand, the more black people are getting weapons to protect themselves.
Yeah, and again, to really look at the situation and sit there and say, my question is that what makes everybody the enemy in his eyes?
Well, if you it's just like a big bully. If you don't agree with that particular person, because see, that person becomes all knowing, all seeing, all everything. They know you can't tell them anything. You can't tell scientists cannot even tell this man something, and they've studied something related to science for years, and he all of a sudden becomes the expert of everything.
Well, see, and again, I'm glad you brought that out of him being an expert and him talking as being the expert. Well, if he was such an expert, then why is it that we're at 218,000?
No, 221,000.
That he, if he was the one and knew of everything, how come he has not done anything to help those people and protect those people?
Yeah. The issue here is that. Before the election, the people who lived next door to me, I was over there to their house talking to them about some receiver because of the person who, the wife of the husband was heavily into
singing. She's a fantastic. She has nice sound, nice good knowledge of timing and all that. Good breathing controls and a lot of it. Does not sing all the same kind of stuff that you hear me do, but very knowledgeable about music, and she wanted some amplification of the music that she was doing in her house, and so she asked me to come over and help, which I had no problem with that. For some strange reason, because of the election was coming close, we got into that topic. Why wouldn't we vote for Clinton versus, and he said, she just lies all over the place about everything. And I said, where did you get that information from? He said, well, she lied about this and she lied about that. I said, well, why do you believe she told a lie? And he said, well, I heard it on television. I said, well, what channel do you watch? And he said, Fox News. I said, well, you're going to hear just about anything on Fox. They are strong supporters of just about every racial contingency that you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got into a major discussion. His wife said, I'm voting for Clinton. And he says, I'm voting for Trump. And I said, if you vote for Trump, you're trying to put me back into slavery. And he looked at me and said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you're a white man and I'm a black man. And you don't understand what he means when he says we're going to take you back to a time when this country was good. Outstanding.
Great.
Well, that's during what's called King Cotton. And people who were involved with King Cotton, which made it king, were slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that he's going to take us, as far as the code is concerned, that he had thrown out there to a whole bunch of crazies that they were talking about putting people of color back into a second-class structure. Maybe not slavery, but putting them all the way back. When you take four steps forward, you're going to experience 25 steps backwards. And that's about where we are right now.
Yeah, I mean, his continuance about of saying that, you know, people are burning the cities down and people are out there demonstrating, like, as far as I remember and as I know, we have the right to assemble. We have a right to demonstrate. How else are we voicing our opinion?
No, but we don't have a right to burn things down. That's not right. And I don't condone. I do feel that's inappropriate for people of color or anybody to try to burn anything down that's not theirs and to destroy it. And I'd like to go one step further, but I do and have read about some of the massacres that took place back in the early 1900s. One was a Kansas City, and one was a massacre that took place in Ohio, Toledo, Ohio massacre, where over 500 black people were killed. These were white people. They would burn their house down, and when the people came outside,
exactly.
They would shoot them.
So when you talk about what things are doing today and what they did before,
they got away with it.
Exactly.
They said, black people. But see, I think it's not black people who are doing this.
No.
I think these are militia who are doing it and blaming it on black people.
Right.
Look, ladies and gentlemen, I would love to have continued this conversation. It's a very fruitful one. But time on the clock says get and move over. So it's time to go. We are in the midst of a real problem health-wise. We are in the midst of a problem in terms of our society going down the tubes. And hopefully somewhere along this continuum of elections, we will do much better. I want to thank my guest today, Paul Willis, and for being with me and discussing some of the issues that we have in our society. And so until Friday, this is Getting It Done. with Paul Willis and Dr. Dean. Have a good day, people, and have a good week.